welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, joining you today for episode 28 from swampy Houston, Texas. How are you, Dan?
Oh, I'm pretty swampy myself, actually. My apartment building doesn't believe they need to turn on the chillers until June, and it doesn't matter what's going on with the actual weather. So it's about 86 degrees here, and in my apartment, I came back yesterday, and it was 95.
Wow. I would say, to be fair, it literally went from winter to summer in a single weekend. I mean, this is, I think, climate change for most cities where, like, spring just ceases to exist. And Chicago, it seems like the shortest spring yet, like 12 hours of spring.
Yeah, we basically had like, an Irish spring for like 3 months of just pissing down rain, 45 degrees, cloudy. And then all of a sudden it was like blazing hot.
That temperature, was it supposed to be the climate of Baton Rouge by 2040? Perhaps it'll come a little sooner for you. Well, I say here in Houston, you just have to get used to it. I'm here for a couple of days speaking to Hines, which is one of the world's larger integrated developers of real estate. So doing a thing there. But yeah, I went to the reception last night, and there was a woman there actually wearing a wool turtleneck under a wool jacket. And I'm like, is your internal body temperature 50 degrees? Turns out she was a Houstonian native. So she just simply had acclimated over time. It was very impressive.
Wow. That must be a reaction to like the aggressive air conditioning that's just ubiquitous everywhere.
That's what I was thinking too. I forget who it was. I think it was the original owner of the Houston Astros who liked to like basically build a fire in his fireplace in the summer with the air conditioning on. So like, you know, like to maintain the temperature at a nice, again, chilly 50 degrees, and then, you know, then have a nice roaring fire to offset him. But appropriate here, as I'm looking currently out the window at Minute Maid Park, the Houston Astros baseball stadium, I'm in downtown Houston, which, like so many other cities, actually, at least in this corner of it, has demolished much of the streetscape to build parking for sports stadia. So, but there are some lovely bones here. Houston's so overlooked by urbanists. You know, I mean, I think it's overtaken Chicago as the third largest city in the United States at this point. And it gets overshadowed, I feel, by Austin in particular as like the belle of the ball right now of American cities. And then obviously sort of like Dallas-Fort Worth, I've been to a lot more. But yes, it has a charming downtown. I will certainly give it that. I enjoyed walking around and sweating my ass off.
Did you explore the tunnel system? I understand they have a very nice underground tunnel system.
I did not know about the tunnel system. I will have to save that for my next trip. And I have not explored the zoning, which, you know, again, like, you know, if we play urbanist bingo, it's like, Houston, do you know there's no zoning? Which is technically not true, but you still end up with like bizarre multifamily apartments near highway interchanges and other sorts of like urban forms that don't generally go together. But yeah, it's been interesting. Yesterday, I actually listened to Richard Florida. Rich, if you're listening, it was great to hear you again. His talk has not changed much since the pandemic. That was my biggest takeaway. I mean, you know, I expect him to be a little triumphalist because, you know, I always thought for 20 years, I've always thought creative class theory was, if not wrong, then certainly overblown. And I feel like post-pandemic remote work and cities turning themselves even more actively into playgrounds to get people back is actually rendering him right, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's always a thing where like you know, where Richard has arrived belatedly at good ideas that I have had and then proceeds to popularize them more than I have. And I'm like, I should be better at this, but I am not. But yeah, he was looking tan and fit and trim and doing his thing. And it was interesting. I mean, he arrived at two things that I thought were particularly trenchant. One, like, you know, he's changed. I'll give this. We should popularize this instead of live, work, play. I think he's doing I think he added to it. I think it's live, work, play, connect. That was his big thing, obviously. The socialization, the serendipity, you know my spiel on this. So I thought it was interesting to see Richard come around to that. And then the other one, which I also really liked, is he arrived at that we need to see the cities need to build family-oriented multifamily apartments. And that, you know, the whole trend for the last decade at least has been the fact that like downtowns across the United States in particular have undergone what's been called youthification, where like literally they are designed now for perpetually young 20-something cohorts in small apartments and amenities that appeal to single or childless 20-somethings. And when they age out to have families, well, off to the urban periphery with you, like out to the exurbs kind of thing where the housing starts are. Or now post-pandemic, like, you know, get out of New York, go move to Dallas, you know, or Plano, or more technically correct. So anyway, so it was interesting to sort of see him arrive at that too. But yeah, it's been an interesting time. Lots of discussion of NEOM as well, and lots of discussion of the metaverse and decentralized
my
finance.
My two favorite places.
I know, exactly. NEOM, digital twins, crypto. I was like, okay, I'm just going to just write some more emails here and just keep one ear cocked on this. But we'll be interesting to see what I managed to come up with today. But you've been traveling a bit too. Where have you been?
I was recently in the American Pacific Northwest and what is sometimes referred to as the Canadian Riviera, which is Vancouver and Victoria and then down to Portland, Oregon. The occasion of my visit was a research project that we're conducting for the Council on Tall Buildings, which is on the future of mass timber high rises. And unsurprisingly, because of all the trees that are growing in that region, and the ones that haven't burned down in forest fires, are being used to create this new-ish product, engineered mass timber that now can go higher because the codes have been revised to allow it. So what we're basically looking at is, you know, whereas before you couldn't go past, you know, say 5 or 6 stories in timber before the fire authorities got really nervous. Now the code has, and at least in Canada and United States, has said you can go to 18 stories without too much trouble. And it seems like developers are kind of champing at the bit to do that. So went to see a project in Victoria and another a bunch of consultants who are working on similar projects in Vancouver. And then in Portland was the International Mass Timber Conference. Some 2,000 people in a room was the first time that I've done that in probably 3 years, which was a little bit unnerving, especially after I heard that some people picked up a certain virus we shall not name after having been there. But fortunately, all the international travel that this required and the varying requirements between the US and Canada meant that I got tested like 4 or 5 times during the course of a week. So I was pretty confident that I was not a carrier. But I'll say, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm behind this construction technique. And they got some really, you know, banner speakers for the event. They had first keynote was Shigeru Ban, of course, who's famous for building.
I was just going to say, if you have a mass timber conference and you don't invite Shigeru Ban, what are you doing? I mean, like literally between the cardboard cathedrals and the wooden high rises, like that's going to be his legacy at this point.
Totally. So that's what he talked about. Yeah, he was great, very charming, you know, and just really, really beautiful projects with almost working with practically nothing, you know, like sonotubes. The second speaker was Ginny Gang, who actually does have quite a few mass timber high rises in the pipeline. She hasn't actually built any recently, although she was able to show some of her work that are more in the sculpture category, like the feature at Lincoln Park Zoo here in Chicago, or Lincoln Park Pond, I should say.
A genie classic, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yep. Perfect for wedding photographs, very Instagrammable. And then the Learning Center at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. There was more than I realized. She has done more timber than I realized. And bonus fact, she's really good at axe throwing. We learned this in two different ways. Firstly, by looking at the sponsored axe throwing competition, which only opened once alcohol began to be served. And she did a pretty good job of hurling the axe. And then in her presentation, she showed how she had also hurled an axe, or rather a hatchet, on a farm in Southern Illinois where she was sourcing the wood for her Michigan project. And she almost sort of had a Crocodile Dundee moment, you know, like that's not an axe, that's a hatchet. You know, she was showing us how it was done.
That's very genie. As someone who's been, I can't say quite invited to the offsites, but certainly have been on the mailing list and talked to the people who've attended, like the Studio Gang offsites that they do every summer are very, very friendly towards hatchet throwing. I'm pretty sure that seems like very on brand for genie that way. So. But that does sound like a setup for like a Mad Men lawnmower moment there. Like, you know, let's start drinking and then start throwing some axes around at the timber conference. But
yeah, it was not difficult to picture it going terribly wrong. But I guess there were some professionals there. And by professionals, I mean like literally men dressed in kilts, and some of whom had facial hair that made me like do a double take to see if perhaps this was the missing the guy from, oh, God. I'm totally blanking. Why am I not remembering his name? The guy who jumped from the plane and was lost in...
oh, yes. D.B. Cooper.
Yes, D.B. Cooper.
There you go. As I say,
I only named my band after him. I couldn't remember his name.
It's to be fair, we've all lost some of that, some of our recall there from COVID. I'm pretty sure I lost 2% of my recall. I'm glad I did Jeopardy before I caught COVID and or had kids. I'm not sure I would have performed quite as well. Well, that sounds like quite a good show in there. Yeah, and I know exactly what you mean about the giant halls. I mean, for listeners who have not been back out in the world, like truly in earnest, like I was in Vegas a week ago. God, all blurs together. I was in Vegas a week ago for Explore 22, which was Expedia Group's big confab there. Sort of, I was there talking about sort of the intersection of like vacation rentals with housing, like the financialization of one's own homes continues in earnest, Dan. Let me just tell you that. But yeah, 3,000 people in a Vegas ballroom at Aria, not a single mask in sight. The entire wall on far side was an LED screen. It was, yeah, it was, you know, production values of like an Apple keynote and just like thrilling and terrifying to be indoors with 3,000 people without a mask. And it's just like, you know, yeah, just, you know, taking reality a little raw there, I guess, you know. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. But yeah, I mean, I went to, you know, you could see the whole fifth wave creeping through, by the way. I went to my first live show since the pandemic last night here in Houston. And the act I went to go see, Toro y Moi, canceled that day, as it turned out, when they didn't take the stage because someone in the group had caught COVID. And so they couldn't go on. So,
oh, no.
I hope to see it at the edges there. Like, you know, COVID's definitely back. But yeah.
I hope it's not prescient, but both by the title of the artist and where, and that they're trying to travel internationally. But I have a show tonight. A great band, by the way. Do you know Destroyer?
Oh, yes. Yes. Only by reputation. But yeah, where are they playing?
At the Thalia Hall here in Chicago. And I'm hoping that everything goes smoothly.
Very nice. Well, I wish you luck in that one. We'll see.
More love from the Pacific Northwest, or the Canadian Riviera, as I should say.
Yeah, exactly. Ah, well, what else has been going on in architecture? I'd say the craziest thing, there's a couple crazy stories which we just discussed. The craziest one to me, which I had seen on Twitter, is the they're in Chicago, right? The Durban Renewal Project, where the GSA is going to demolish historic skyscrapers because someone can see into a federal judge's chambers. Do I understand that story correctly? Because that's bananas.
That is correct.
They can't put up window shades? I don't understand the story.
It's just patently ridiculous. The consumers in the Century buildings are two historic skyscrapers in downtown Chicago on State Street, and they have been abandoned for a number of years. There was a deal under the Rahm Emanuel administration to pass them to a private investor who was interested in turning them into a combination of condos, apartments, and hotel rooms. And that was quashed by the GSA via the complaints of a judge who didn't like the idea that people who were occupying those buildings could look into his courtrooms. And that was backed up by the FBI, various protective services, and then, you know, echoed by the Lightfoot administration. And now Lightfoot is the mayor of Chicago, and now Senator Dick Durbin has earmarked $52 million for the demolition of these neighboring buildings that have been there since 1910 and 1915, respectively, and the Dirksen Federal Building has been there since 1974. So this is not like a new situation. The only thing that's changed is just the political winds.
As I say, this is where insert really dark joke about, you know, judiciary overreach here in America. This is the urbanist version of that there, of an out of control judiciary.
So Elizabeth Blasius called it Durban Renewal, which is just awesome. I'm hoping that sticks.
Thank you, Dick Durbin, for bringing home the earmarks of your constituents. This is definitely not what I had in mind.
Yeah, I mean, so it's going to end up being like, you know, if it happens, it'll be like, so there'll be a gravel pit on State Street, which is already just hemorrhaging businesses.
which they've spent, yeah, well, there's that post-COVID, but also like, I forget, what was the block? I mean, as a kid, I used to go ice skating on State Street across from Marshall Field on that block site that was—
Yeah, Block 37.
Block 37. It took them decades to actually put a mixed-use project on that site, so I can't wait to see them finally doing something with that site by what, the 2060s, the way things are going? Jeez.
And hopefully they don't, you know, if they do end up demolishing this and building a plaza, quote, end quote, that's, you know, fortified, quote, end quote, you know, my only request, if they go forward with that, is that they keep the truck entrance with the raised, you know, deflectors and the ground and the bollards and all that, and the fake palm trees that are overarching.
Oh, very nice.
The entrance, because it's already an essay in taste. Mies would be pleased.
If you want the last 20 years of American urbanism there, the security theater of post 9/11 meets, you know, just terrible, terrible placemaking, you know, surveillance placemaking, or yeah, security theater placemaking right there. Oh, well, speaking of demolitions, sadly, although I was never as big a nostalgist as many others, but the Nagagun Capsule Tower has finally been demolished. I guess I'm supposed to be sad, but I mean, I don't understand what they're not going to replace it. Because I remember this, I bring this up because the reason I'm less sad than others is because one of the things I do respect the most about Japanese urbanism is the fact that they are perhaps the last society, last certainly global North society, it feels like, to truly believe that, like, oh, we should demolish it. We can rebuild it better. Like, you know, obviously the United States, we lost all faith in the ability to build projects that are better than the ones we're tearing down, hence our conversation just now. But you know, I remember when they tore down the Hotel Akura that you and I went to in 2016, and we went to like that lobby where, like, you know, the nicotine was like an amber in the air, but like apparently it's been rebuilt perfectly and better than ever because it's been modernized. So I guess this is not the case, but like, should we be that sad about the Nagagun Capsule Tower? You tell me. I'm open to this, but it feels like there's a lot of crying on Twitter about it. And, you know, apparently it was not that great of a structure. I mean, I live with Habitat. Habitat's iconic, but Habitat's not great to live in, evidently, given the leaking, as many buildings have.
Well, I think everything's, you know, with any kind of innovative building that pushes the envelope, and I mean this in a literal sense.
That is actually pushing the envelope, building envelope.
It always comes down to the detailing and the maintenance. And if either of those things was not executed properly, you know, the building is doomed. So, I mean, if the more surfaces you put on a building, the more right angles you put on it, or any kind of angles or junctions, the more opportunities you create for ingress of moisture and, you know, and rust forming on the rebar inside the concrete and what have you. And the thing is, with the Nakagen Capsule Tower, the intention was always that these modules would be demountable, that they would be removable. And that was never done. No one ever took them up on it. You know, the original design concept, it was, I think it just would have been too difficult. I think they would have, I'm not that familiar with what the actual technology is that keeps these things joined in, but I don't think it resembles what we would think of today as, you know, the shipping container, you know, demountable type, temporary structures. You know, these are big pieces of concrete that are latched onto other big pieces of concrete and a superstructure. So I don't know how effective that would be. I think what people are probably most sad about is just the whole concept of 70s living, or the 70s concept of modernity. You know, the idea that there would be a built-in LP player, you know, in the wall unit. That's pretty tight. But, you know, it would be that hard to take one of those modules, just hollow it out, and then rebuild it as the hippest bar in Tokyo. I don't think it'd be that hard.
Yeah, the things did circulate on Twitter where I guess there were some modules that were not installed into the building, and people have them in various locations or fixed them up. So, like, it is, I guess, sadly, they won't reuse the modules from the tower itself. But yes, to your point, is like, yeah, those modules did find an afterlife. It would be interesting to see if someone, I don't know, I'm about to suggest that someone should, like, you know, reverse engineer that and like create new Nakagen capsules to, like, for those kinds of uses. But that veers perilously close to shipping container urbanism, so I retract the idea. But you're right. You're right about modernity, though. I was going to say, just as an aside on that one, I think the purest concentration I have seen of high modernity ever, I think, was in the basement of the Ford Foundation headquarters in New York, in their auditorium, where the built-in ashtrays into every seat, and I think they were brass. At first, I thought they were actually gold. I was like, that's a little on the nose, but yeah, like built into this incredibly conforming auditorium seat in the Ford Foundation, your ashtray, of course.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to build in all the mod cons. That's the way it's got to be.
Absolutely. And then what's our final scandal du jour in architecture this week? This one I haven't followed as closely, but there's some sort of kerfuffle with a First Nation casino in Arkansas, or what's happening there?
Oh, yeah, this is fun. So there is a casino under construction or under design in Northwest Arkansas, which was designed by a firm based out of Memphis. And then they had a local architect doing the executive work. And what it sounds like is that basically the design architect got fired off the job for being too much of a design architect. It was Marlon Blackwell. And then the local, which I hadn't heard of previously, was accused by Marlon Blackwell of stealing the design. Which is shitty, by the way. I mean, the whole thing, it shouldn't be built, period. So it's kind of like,
No aesthetic judgments here. Come on. Let's, you know, I mean, we could argue they don't necessarily need a casino, but hey, who am I to question the revenues and finances of a First Nation? So.
Well, and I think, you know, the question that it's raising for the architecture community is, you know, who owns these drawings? Who owns the design? How does IP work? Where does the copyright protection law come into play? This whole episode just reminds me of what would routinely happen in China with American or overseas architects designing XYZ building and, you know, the client rejecting it and saying, yeah, you know what, I don't think this is going to work. And then 6 months later, they would see an aerial view of their exact project designed exactly as they designed it, except that they hadn't been paid for the other design stages.
I think that happened repeatedly to Zaha Hadid architects alone. I mean, that happened more than once, but yeah.
Yeah, so it feels a little bit like that, but obviously this is going to be, you know, played out in an American court of law. So I'm sure that all of the I's will be dotted and all of the T's will be crossed and all of the lawyers will get paid.
I'd say if there's one thing we can be sure of in America, it's that all the lawyers will get paid. Oh, well, all right. So that's that. This is sort of a fun interim episode for us between guests. But so we'll get some more guests soon. But what have you been reading here? Like, I know you've got some books on your list. I envy you. He with the time to read. And yeah, what else have you been thinking about?
Well, I've got a burgeoning library here, but that doesn't necessarily mean I have time to read. But I this is sort of my way of publicly committing to doing a review of these books and also to interviewing their authors if possible. So on my bookshelf, let's see, we've got Green Obsession by Stefano Boeri Architetti. Stefano Boeri, of course, is very well known for having designed the Bosco Verticale in Milan, which is a two building apartment complex that has trees on every available nook and cranny, every balcony. And
you've all seen it. Like, that image is burned into my head. You know, the iconic green skyscraper, whatever that means.
Yeah. And he is also, you know, he's also, been able to develop it, you know, into a replicable model that he's, you know, got in China and he's got one in Nanjing. He's got one in Lausanne, Switzerland. He has been involved in a lot of things, you know, along the lines of trying to replicate this model. But he's actually gone a bit further than that with this book. I mean, basically, he's assembled pretty much all the thinkers that he could on the subject of, you know, what is green architecture? And that includes people like Jane Goodall, who has a lot to say about our relationship with nature. So it's very philosophical, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's very focused. It's kind of like a bunch of lectures that he's given, you know, interviews that he's given over the past years, including, like, you know, it was a great way, I think, to capitalize on the lockdowns of COVID. You know, basically they just transcribed all the interviews and all the speeches that he's given while, you know, sitting in his office or his home, you know, being interviewed by people on Zoom. And it's in a very nice package. You know, it's a lovely book.
Very nice. All right. What else you got?
I've got Celebrating Public Architecture, which is a somewhat generic sounding title, probably because the program that it describes is unpronounceable. The government of Belgium, which some have called the ugliest country in Europe, with
that's
respect
so unfair,
to its
which,
modern
which,
architecture. Which I know, it's terrible, right?
That's so unfair. I mean, Flanders is that. Also, we should discuss too. I mean, there was just a piece that went about the incredible investments in public architecture that the Flemish side of Belgium at least has been investing in. So,
well, that's precisely what the book is about. The book is basically turning that notion on its head.
There you go. Yes, I've seen. I mean, the image has been floating around. Okay, tell me more about this, because you can tell again. Maybe I should do more reading of books and less reading of Twitter here. But I've been seeing a celebration of some of those iconic images from that.
Exactly. And what's, I think, most remarkable about it is that, you know, the one that gets the biggest headlines, of course, was the Zaha Hadid project that has the floating imposed, almost Zeppelin-shaped, fractal Zeppelin floating above the, you know, sort of Empire-era building.
That's the one I keep saying.
Mm-hmm. But there's many others by more obscure architects, you know, including a lot of first-timers. And basically what they did is they had an open competition, which I believe was paid. And it was pretty much all based on the merits as opposed to who you know and who's famous and who's a Starchitect. So, you know, they're getting good architecture from both Starchitects and from you know, first timers who are emerging firms. So it's kind of feels like I haven't read all the way through it, and I do want to speak to the head of the program as part of the podcast and kind of get their insight on it. But it seems like a kind of win-win-win, which you don't hear about that often in architecture.
Yeah, really. It's some of that process reminds me a little bit, although you still had a star architect in charge of the famous story of Utzorn winning the Sydney Public Opera House competition, which I believe Saarinen was judging on a plane, naturally, but found the iconic design while going through the various submissions, and it was a fairly democratic process. So it seems like a little bit like that there. That is interesting, and they should be blinding these entries more. I'd be curious a little about how entries get blinded in these kinds of public competitions. Just you hear the stories now about doing music auditions, where obviously the identity of the performer is hidden so that you don't make biased judgments against women in particular. But it'd be interesting, how do you do double blind submissions of architecture firms for randomized architecture trials, perhaps? Lots to be learned there, I suppose.
I mean, how far away are we from the masked architect? I think I just had a good idea.
There you go. Well, again, we got to try to get the hustle architect on here. Vitruvius is pretty good at hiding his identity on there through various things.
That's true. That is long overdue.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if we can get him to grind here a bit on a future upcoming episode. Well, that's about it. What else have you been doing? I'm headed from here. I'm in Houston today. I'm going to New York from here. So I would say my bit of culture that I'm getting, I was going to see James McAvoy as Cyrano de Bergerac at BAM tomorrow night, which should be great. One of my favorite plays. Apparently, it's been almost completely rewritten in English, as opposed to just sort of doing a translation from the Bell epic play. And I don't know. I plan to, I'm back in New York. I don't know what to do there. I guess I'm going to fall back into earlier rhythms. I am looking forward to seeing Governor's Island, which I feel like I'm losing a relative slowly. It's fading away. It's going to turn into a tech hub and a clean tech hub. But I will always remember Governor's Island a decade ago when it was still them trying to figure out what to do with that site kind of thing. So that's perhaps the most architecturally significant thing I'm planning to see, unless you have recommendations of anything hyper new in New York.
Oh my gosh. I haven't been to New York in 3 years now.
Yeah.
And I haven't been to Governor's Island since it was just barely a lump and it was just a pile of dirt. And I went in a horrific rainstorm in 2009. So my memories of it are kind of damp.
You sort of manifest some guests?
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great idea. Well, I definitely, I don't know if we can get Mr. Boeri himself, but I'd love to get somebody from Stefano Boeri Architetti to talk about that Green Obsession book. I'd love to get the head of the Flemish architecture program that got all these interesting buildings on there. We've got Stefan Ahl. I think he's going to be talking to us about his book Super Tall, which falls right into the squarely into the camp of the council here.
I was going to say, man, that's the most on-brand thing we've ever had on this podcast. Sounds great.
It really is. I would love to talk to Richard Francis Jones, who is an Australian architect that just came out with a book called Truth and Lies in Architecture. It is some really arresting stuff. As opposed to just being a sort of way for an architect to shill philosophy over their projects, it is really just a bunch of really sort of searching essays, and I would say borderline damning. There's one in particular that is called The Fall of the Architect that talks about, what is our predisposition, and this one really hits home because of my day job. What is this predisposition to build tall? Why do we always want to stand near the edge? And he's basically sort of saying, we have this sort of dance with the death impulse or something like that. He said it very articulately, but I really want to hear him say it.
Yeah. Yes. The reason we build tall is so we can imagine ourselves falling to our deaths kind of thing.
That's almost literally what he said. Yeah.
A death drive. I could sort of see that. That is interesting. I will say this as a quick aside, and I think I'm under NDA, so I can't get too much into it, but I had a call just yesterday actually with someone who's interested in the future of central business districts. And one of their criteria, this plays directly to you and the council, one of the criteria they're thinking about is iconic skylines, signaling, how do we signal the importance and or just the general, the worthiness of this place. You can imagine the kind of client who's very interested in that kind of, those kinds of aesthetics. And
yes, I can.
Because I actually push back on don't focus on tall buildings. Like that's great in movie credits, when the asteroid is about to strike or Godzilla emerges. But really, it's about, and I try to point out, the fact that, you know, Wall Street is probably more defined as a symbol of place by actually the Charging Bull sculpture. And I thought it was telling that when the crypto bros in Miami, before all the crypto went away, cry. Sorry, I have to have Schadenfreude right now. I'm kind of glad that my net worth is tanking as long as it takes down crypto with it. But the crypto bros like unveiled like a new like electric bull kind of thing in Miami at the Bitcoin conference. So I thought that was kind of telling there. And that was my point of this rambling story here is that I was arguing like, yeah, you need to get away from building all of this, like get back to human scale placemaking for these kinds of things to define these places. And so I found myself interesting pushing back against the notion of like skyline as definition of a place. So I'd be curious to chat about that with him. We should have him on and expand upon those ideas, our death drives and how they take shape in various forms.
What I always tell people, I guess this is what I would say, when I do my NDA conversations about how do we have an iconic city, I try to emphasize vertical urbanism instead of just tall buildings. And that is a brand, and is a brand that we, you know, project here. But what I basically end up saying is if you can build something where the humans are able to discern other humans at a distance, like in other words, they don't dissolve to the point of looking like ants, you've done something correctly. So don't, you know, if you're going to build vertically integrated villages, then they need to be dense. They need to have crossings at multiple levels. They can't just be a bunch of isolated iconic towers. If you're going to build high, you need to build high density at all levels, including above the street level. And that's, you know, basically I end up suggesting that, you know, you do something more like a more like terraced housing, but at scale.
Very cool. All right. Well, I would say we should build a whole episode around that as well there, get more into that. It would be fun to actually have you talk about more about your day job there, if we can sort of cross the stream, so to speak there.
Well, maybe when I know another sort of like a long-term, you know, let's limb a guest into existence. We could have Mosu Safdie on when he releases his memoir and ask him about where he thinks vertical urbanism has gone since kind of coming up with this idea with Habitat in 67.
That indeed, I would say that's a good place to leave it. Yes, listeners, we've been plotting for a while, but Safdie's putting out his memoir this fall, so we've got him on our long list here of someone to have on to talk about his career, starting, of course, famously with Habitat and following through. So more awesome. Where that came from. All right, well, let's tie this off here. We're just getting into like basically talking about future episodes rather than taping them. So thank you, as always, for listening, whoever you are in Sweden that gets us on the top 60 or so list there as we continue to cling to this. And yeah, always a pleasure, Dan.
Indeed. Enjoy the rest of Houston and New York, especially. I'm jealous.
Thanks. We'll catch up soon. I'll tell you what I found.
All right.
They told me it was clever. Jessica's gone on vacation on the dark side of town forever. Who knew? Who knew? I wrote a song for America. They told me it was clever. Jessica's gone on vacation on the dark side of town forever. Who knew?